Welcome to Inside Analog Photo. I'm your host, Scott Shepard, and the Inside Analog Photography radio program is brought to you by Fujifilm, making life more colorful. You know, they have really cool instant pack film, 3.25 by 4.25, 4 by 5, but even more so in the country now is Instax. This is a large, wide format instant camera. Beautiful color film. Really fun to play with. Parties, documentation, law enforcement, everybody's using the Instax now. This stuff rocks. You definitely got to check it out over at www.fujifilmusa.com/professional, making life more colorful. Our friends over at Richard Photo Lab at richardphotolab.com, DR5 for black and white chrome at dr5.com. Our friends over at Iger Studios, the place to have all of your film scanned for your digital hybrid workflow. Definitely cool stuff. Aztec Premier drum scanner. You will not find a better scan anywhere on this planet. You can check them out over at www.igerstudios, that's E-I-G-E-R-S-T-U-D-I-O-S, igerstudios.com. Great stuff going on with Lenny and the guys over at Iger. Good stuff. Our media partners at the Analog Photography User Group over at www.apug.org, the place on the web for all things analog photographic process. And our friends at Upstrap for the camera strap that will not slide off your shoulder, upstrap-pro.com. We got a great show today. We're going to have with us Stephen Schaub. Stephen is the leader of the Fidgetal Revolution. You might have heard of his radio program on iTunes, his website at fidgetalrevolution.com. A lot of great stuff going on with Stephen. Stephen is a hybrid artist. We're going to talk today about analog capture, digital output, and a lot of cool stuff that's going on with Stephen. Stephen, how you doing today?
Pretty good. How are you?
Good. Thanks for joining us here on Inside Analog Photos. Stephen, we want to talk today about what you're up to, your beautiful photography, the Fidgetal Revolution, and all the great stuff you're into. So why don't you start off, Stephen, by giving our listeners a little background on yourself.
Okay. I've been photographing for a little over 20 years. I fell in love with photography while I was in the Marine Corps. And while serving in the first Gulf War, I really sort of got into photography and had a chance of working with a lot of military photographers. After getting out of the military, I went to RIT. I have a degree in photographic arts and sciences. Met my wife actually at RIT, who was in a master's program there at RIT, and worked as a commercial photographer shooting architectural photography, portraits, and also doing my own fine artwork. All of this was sort of pre-digital. When I was at RIT, digital was really, really just getting started. Actually, my senior year, they made this huge investment in digital technology, but I never really got to take advantage of that. Moved to Vermont, opened our studios, and did a lot of commercial work here, and sort of was able to get involved through Berger Photographic and other traditional companies in sort of testing and looking at traditional media, traditional films. Then we were asked by Steve Enschel to write for Photovision magazine at one time, and I did a lot of different articles on analog photography, and my wife had a column that she wrote. And sort of saw what was happening at that time with digital and analog and where things were changing. Sort of hopped on the digital bandwagon fairly early, probably about 10, 11 years ago. Always kept my toes, though, in the analog at the same time. But I was doing all this work for all these different digital companies over the years. And I started noticing that there wasn't necessarily the best relationship forming between the digital folks and the analog photographers. After a couple of years of doing research and testing for digital companies as well as the analog, I realized that there was a lot of misinformation and a lot of bad things that were happening, so I decided to start the Fidgetal Revolution. Fidgetal stands for film and digital, so it's sort of a dynamic fusion of both technologies. My wife and I co-authored the Fidgetal Revolution Manifesto, which was sort of a book that sort of threw out our ideas as to what we were talking about. The site's been live now for almost 2 years.
Wow, pretty interesting. So let's talk about your current workflow, your current photography. What you're doing is you're a very large opponent of this hybrid workflow where you do analog capture, but then all of your output is via digital.
Correct. I believe that in terms of image quality, in terms of maximum value for your dollar, and maximum creative potential for really pushing work, shooting film is, in my opinion, kind of a no-brainer. Unless you're in a situation where you need a really fast turnaround for a file, the quality of film on a good quality scanner is really hard to beat. Scanner technology right now is as good as it's probably ever going to get. So you're really working with the best of current technology, whereas digital cameras and stuff are always continuing to sort of get better. So I'd rather work with sort of the best that's currently available. So I shoot film, whether it's black and white or color negative or cross-process material. Everything is scanned in Mekon scanner. most of my work's in Photoshop, and I print all my works on a DaVinci printer. I think there's 8 of them now in the world. It's a 12-color, 54-inch wide, sort of a hybrid printer also. It's running hexachrome color profile, so it's running 5 blacks and 7 colors. I mean, the beauty of the system is that it allows me to print on virtually any media. I can print on rare Japanese gompies as thin as 2 or 3 GSM, and out to Italian Fabriano papers as thick as 700 GSM. And so it gives my photography a lot of options, from working from that great piece of film to start with, having all the creative possibilities of editing and retouching of Photoshop, but then being able to print on these beautiful, uncoated, handmade papers on the printer.
Sure. Now, what's your thoughts on the DaVinci printer in comparison to what's currently available from, let's say, Epson and HP? Have you had a chance to play with anything in those realms? People that are doing hybrid workflow, is it even obtainable to get DaVinci stuff, and how's that working?
Well, the only printer that comes close to the color gamut of the DaVinci is the new Epson 7900 series, the newest ones they just came out with that are hexachrome profiles. I mean, I truly consider them sort of like a mini DaVinci. The software company, Ergosoft, who I've done a lot of work with, they make the RIP that powers the DaVinci. They also make RIPs that power the Epson printers and the Canon printers. And the Canon printers and the Epson printers are all really good machines. The DaVinci, though, has several advantages. First off, it runs a K5 black set, which is by John Cones. So it's a totally neutral black ink set that run in the printer. The nice part is that I can turn off the color inks and just use the quad tone printing set and make neutral black and whites. I can add a color as a spot color and do a toned print, or I can use the entire set however I want. And the ink set that's in the DaVinci is arguably the most archival color ink set ever made. It's the original Epson 7000 series inks, and which were a really heavy pigment load ink. They were very stable, but in the original Epson 7000 series printers, they had a lower color gamut. That's why Epson and all the people went to these new color gamut inks. The DaVinci, though, because you're running so many inks with the additions of all the blacks, has the largest archival color gamut of any printer currently on the market. But having said that, I still like the Epson printers, the Canon printers. They're all good machines. It all depends how you use them.
Sure. So let's talk about some topics that you traditionally have been talking about. Of course, you have the Digital Revolution website. You also do a very cool podcast. It's got a lot of great information.
Thank you.
Tell me about your thoughts here lately on analog capture when it comes to the current stock of film, C41, black and white, chrome, and the thought process behind, okay, well, if I'm going to be a hybrid artist, I'm going to shoot analog and I'm going to scan it, does it really matter? Should I shoot C41? Should I shoot chrome? Should I even bother with black and white? Because I can make it black and white in Photoshop. What's your thoughts behind this analog capture medium?
Okay. First off, I'll say that, unfortunately, a lot of great films have gone by for manufacturing issues, for a drop in sales, I mean, all sorts of reasons. A lot of wonderful, wonderful films are gone, but at least there are some great films that are still being made. My two current favorite films are both by Kodak. One is the Kodak Ektar 100, and the other is the BW400CN, which is their black and white chromogenic material. Both of these films are outstanding, especially in the hybrid workflow. I've tested a lot of different films, and these films scan very easily. The black and white material, the BW400CN, has a tremendous exposure latitude. It would not be something that I'd recommend for somebody, obviously, in the darkroom because it has a color mask to it. But for scanning, it's easy to scan. And one of the biggest issues for people who want to scan black and white film is that the silver halide in the negatives cause all sorts of problems with their digital life. So you're better to scan a color negative material and convert it into black and white, as you have suggested. The advantage to the BW400CN is that the grain structure is so fine. At 400 speed, you'd think you're looking at maybe, you know, 100 or 200 speed material. It's that fine. I've tested the exposure latitude really from about 200 out to 1600 is usable as just a standard C41 development. Additionally, the film has no reciprocity until 2 minutes, so it's a very easy film to work with. The Ektar 100 has become sort of my color film of choice, primarily because I love the contrast. The grain is incredibly fine. It scans so easily. Reciprocity characteristics are okay. They're sort of your standard reciprocity, you know, anything after a second you've got to deal with. But it's really a great film. In terms of traditional black and white films, if people were looking to still sort of be in that vein and scan, there's so many options. But I think it's important to think of if your intent is to scan your film, if your intent is to not go in the dark room but scan, then the way you process that film is an important consideration. And I've been a big advocate of a divided developer, or something like a diaphine, primarily because it produces a negative that's more linear. And scanners are linear capture devices. And as a result, you get an increase in density in the shadows and a control of density in the highlights. And it produces a negative that most scanners can hit perfectly, as opposed to a negative, say, process in Rodinal or something like that. It's more difficult for low-end scanners to scan those type of negatives and get good quality results. So I guess if you want to work in traditional black and white material, I think that's fine. I would recommend some sort of divided developer. It makes a lot of sense. X-Tal works as well, but something like a diaphine seems to be better for scanning purposes. Or use something like the BW400CN. Because at the end of the day, if you're printing digitally, I'll make the challenge to people that I could print an image from Tri-X, and I could print an image from BW400CN. And with a couple minutes in Photoshop, I don't think people are going to be able to tell the difference. I really think that the technology is at the point that as long as you have a good quality scan, as long as you have the information going in that's good, what you can do in the digital environment prior to printing is impressive.
Now, do you ever output to analog at all?
No. I have a lot of friends who do, and I've spoken to them extensively. A lot of them do LVTs, or they make digital negatives for the purposes of platinum printing. And I've looked at all of that. But the fact of the matter is, the printer that I'm running with the software is so flexible that the dynamic range that I can reproduce on a digital black and white print or a color print far exceeds what I would be capable of doing in a darkroom print, even with the best match negative. So for me, it makes sense to do everything from the digital end.
And you've had nobody that buys your work, because you guys have a gallery and you, of course, sell your fine art. You've had nobody request anything on true silver paper.
No, and it's funny. Probably 8 years ago, when we first had opened the gallery, digital printing was still sort of being accepted in terms of its archival quality. But when people would come through the studio, I've always sort of prided myself, like especially on some of the handmade papers, you can lay a platinum print next to one of my digital prints, and you would think they were the same thing. You can take a 20X loop, drop it on top of the surface of the print, and you still won't find a dot. It's that precise. It's a different level than a lot of places work, but I think that the visual quality of the prints sort of make the argument not really necessary. People just sort of looked at it. I could tell them about the stability of the prints, the stability of the papers that we were working on, and it hasn't really been an issue for us.
Very, very cool. So let's step back one here. I know that you're digging the Ektar stuff, and of course the BW400CN. It is an incredible piece of film.
It really
so
is.
What's your thought on using different emulsions? Because you shoot chrome, you get this look. You shoot this color neg, you get this look. You shoot this, you get this. You got Fuji, you have this deal, you have this film, and you have all these different looks, and you have these different levels of Portra film and the NC and the VC. Does this matter when you're doing hybrid workflow? And can I just pick one film and just throw the rest in the can and say, you know something? Here's my base analog capture. I'm going to fix everything else on the computer.
Now, here's where I make everybody mad at me. The answer is yes, you could throw everything else away. I mean, I'll just come straight out and say it. And the reason I say that, and this would be truly the case if you're printing digitally, because then you're keeping it within that workflow the whole way. The moment you go back to film, you're obviously adding curves and grain and all sorts of stuff back into the equation. But if you're staying truly within sort of, you shot film, you scanned it, now you're going to print. I mean, in an ideal world for scanning purposes, you're looking for a slightly lower contrast film that has good shadows, controlled highlights, reasonably fine grain with a good layer that's easy to scan. And there are a couple of films that you can find in the market that will give you that. Having a really fine grain film is obviously advantageous because you can always add the grain. There are software programs out there, some for pay, some for free, that emulate the look of film to such an extent and give the photographer so much control over grain and over contrast and over just every single aspect you could ever possibly imagine with regards to looking like a piece of a different film, that it really is kind of scary. I mean, I love still a lot of the old traditional films that I worked with, but the fact of the matter is I can take a BW400CNA, scan it up at a really good optical resolution, one that's not too far, because you don't want to overscan an egg, but one that's right where it should be, bring it into Photoshop, do my standard workflow with it, and bring it into a piece of software. One that I use from time to time is by Alien Skin. It's called Exposures 2. and it emulates an awful lot of different films, from black and white to color, gives you all sorts of different processing effects. The biggest mistake that people make with software like that is that they do it too heavy, and they just sort of really go at it 110%, and as a result, it looks overdone, it looks overplayed, and it looks fake. Yet if you know what these films look like, and that's sort of the biggest thing, if you've got the visual memory and the experience of working with these films, you know what they were really supposed to look like in the first place. The software has so much creative potential that you can push it too far. But I can take a BW400 CNNEG and make it look like Tri-X, I can make it look like HP5, like Acros, like any of those films, and you'd be extremely hard-pressed, especially in the print, to tell the difference. It's amazing when you consider that it's one film looking 10 different ways. I know a lot of people talk about how a black and white negative has a larger range than, say, a traditional, like a chromogenic material does, but all photography is about controlled compression. And at the end of the day, you're only going to be able to get what that print can really give you. And if you look at, like, an ICC profile for a printer, it's actually not that big when you compare it to the actual dynamic range of, say, a transparency and all that kind of stuff. So at the end of the day, a color negative material probably does give you everything you need.
So really, I need to pick my favorite color neg film and just say, guess what? I'm not going to shoot chrome no more. I got better dynamic range, better latitude. I can have it developed at the drugstore up the street if I have to. I can do C40. Well, I was going to get to that.
Are you kidding me? I mean, it's so simple. That's the thing that I think is important about this. I mean, I still shoot black and white films. I have a whole bunch of Tech Pan Frozen that I use for making some zone plates sometimes. I still shoot black and white films that might give me something very specific that's extremely high resolution that might be out of the range of a particular film. Say I'm using a really good Leica lens and I know I can extract a little more data, I very well might choose something that's sort of beyond what some of these films are. But I would say for 95% of your shooting, you could pick a fine-grained color negative film. I like the BW400CN, and maybe pick yourself an 800-speed film that you like, and you're done.
That's
it. You pretty much can emulate everything.
And then otherwise, I guess the same with a color film. Then you pick whatever you like, depending on price-wise. And here's another question for you. I know that you've tested a lot of film, done a lot of scan work, and a lot of people want to understand and know this that don't really understand. You have your consumer-grade of film, Kodak, Fuji, everybody's got consumer, and they have professional-grade film.
Yep.
Of course, you can go to Costco and buy multiple brands of consumer-grade film, really economical.
Yep.
And you can buy it at the drugstore. You can find people that are closing it out. It doesn't matter. What's your thoughts on shooting, let's say, a Fuji Sapira 400 compared to a 400H or a Kodak 200 Gold compared to Portra 160NC?
A lot of that gets into the particular mask technology that they have for scanning. So I've noticed that a lot of the companies have sort of leveled that out, that they're using one or two sort of orange masks in the films itself. Personally, I bought my BW400CN at Walmart. I mean, it was convenient, it's close, I live here in Vermont, it was easy to get. I can take a roll of some of the Fuji Sapira stuff, and you would think it was 400H. You would think it's all these different films. What I'm looking for in a film is the structure of the grain and how it looks when I scan it at what I feel is the maximum resolution. A film that's going to give me the best dynamic range from my blackest black to my whitest white. And some of the amateur films don't do that. That's the only thing. But if you can find one that does, great. And a lot of it also boils down to your scanner. If you're scanning on a $400 or $500 flatbed scanner, you're probably not going to be able to see the difference anyways, because your scanner's not good enough to extract that extra data from that file. And that's sort of one of the other sort of stories here, is that while scanners right now are as good as they're ever going to get, and they're also incredibly cost-effective. I mean, the scanner you buy nowadays for $500, 6 years ago would have cost $4,000. But at the same time, there's a big difference between a flatbed scan of a negative as opposed to a scan on an Imicon or something like a Premiere. Those are whole different levels of scanning, bigger dynamic ranges, and if you have a better piece of film, you can get a little more out of it. I sort of made the joke that I get my film process sometimes over at Rite Aid. I have a lab here in Vermont that also does some of my film, but good C41 process is important. You want to make sure that the place that's processing your film, whether it's the amateur or professional, really cares about the film that they're running and really runs a good control strip, and that kind of stuff is something that shouldn't be overlooked. You can save a few dollars in processing, but at least make sure the place is running more than one film a week.
Your choice is picked in the Ektar 100, and this has been working out for you. What do you use for a faster film if you have a light problem and you're limited?
I've tested a couple recently. I like the Fuji 800Z, and I also like the Portra 800, and I haven't decided which one I like better. I mean, it's kind of funny. I'm doing a lot of handheld stuff right now with my work in very low light, and I was looking for a faster color neg material than, say, 100-speed Ektar, and I looked at a lot of different films. I looked at some 400-speed films in color, some 800-speed. I looked at some of the 1600-speed, which I didn't really care for. And I have to say that the Portra 800 and the Fuji 800Z are both really good films. But you are making that compromise because there is larger grain, so you can control that in the scanning by just sort of bringing down your resolution a little bit and not emphasizing the grain structure, things like that to sort of balance it out. But I would probably go with one of those two films if I was looking for a faster color neg. I haven't decided which one I like best.
Yeah, very interesting. And what's interesting, too, is we talk to a lot of people that use analog capture in a professional environment, mainly wedding people. You had a podcast about this the other day, about people jumping on the bandwagon about film again. But a lot of people that have been shooting digital, and I'm sure you well know this, they're going back to film, especially wedding people, because they can shoot at a stop overexposed. It's creamy and smooth, and guess what? If they have a decent lab, they do nothing.
That's right. That's the one thing about digital is that it is a lot of post-processing time. When the wedding photographer used to drop their 20 rolls off at the lab and they picked their prints up 2 days later. Now, no matter how many actions you write and everything, it is still a lot of post-processing work on all those digital files. And I have a few friends who are wedding photographers who actually shoot the weddings with a handheld 4x5.
Sweet.
And it's really beautiful. The clients love it because it's something different than what everybody else is doing.
No, I think you can't go wrong with analog capture. It's just it has a different look to it. And yes, like you said, you can replicate this with digital. But I think there's more things that people, and we've discussed this before, and you've definitely discussed it a lot on your program, is that, okay, well, I had the latest and greatest, and I got a brand new 1DS Mark III or 1D Mark III or a D3 or a D3X. I got all this cool stuff. I paid $5,000 or $8,000, but guess what? There's a new trick pony coming in 18 months.
Right, and how are you going to possibly get the money back out of that system? I feel that when you scan film, especially if you're running through a fairly decent scanner, there's a really big difference between a 16-bit scan, a true 16-bit scan, and the 8-bit or 14-bit that most digital SLR cameras give you. It's a totally different visual quality. And even if you're going to go in Photoshop and you're going to use these different softwares to emulate different films, it still does look different. I mean, if I were just to shoot BW400CN or the Ektar 100, and I'm just going to run it in a straight line, I'm not going to do anything else to the film, I'm just really going to work with it, there's a very different visual quality when you look at that print compared to a digital capture of the same exact image. And I don't like to say that one is better than the other. I just think that they're different. And I think that that option of having the choice between digital and analog and using the appropriate technology for what artwork or what the commercial job requires is a nice thing for us photographers to have.
Oh, sure. Exactly. I mean, the more you have, the better. The more options you can do. And like you said, some of these cameras have beautiful images digitally right out of them. I've been really impressed with some of the Nikon stuff. It's just been incredible. And I have some really high-end, really expensive Canon stuff. I don't know what to do with it. I still find that my Sigma SD10 shoots a wonderful image, and it's only 3 megapixels.
That's right. That's the thing that's really unfortunate about the digital end, is that there's been this hype about the constant upgrade, upgrade, upgrade. And photographers, unfortunately, at this point, are, in a lot of cases, working basically to pay for that next upgrade. And I've talked about on our website that I feel that it's an unsustainable path for the future of photography. I think that when the upgrade was the new film that came out, or the new paper that you were going to put in your enlarger, that was an upgrade that was sustainable within sort of the way the photographic industry is sort of built. But this new model of every 18 months and maybe even faster technology upgrading from, I mean, all aspects, there's all these different things you have to upgrade now, it worries me. And yet the differences in quality from one upgrade to another, to me, isn't radical enough. And I think a lot of times people get excited about being on that bleeding edge of technology. And I think if they stepped back from it, they'd realize that what they have already is probably good enough for the print sizes that they're making and at the resolution that their printer can even print.
No, I know for a fact I can grab a Mamiya C220 and stick any kind of film in the back, get a bigger piece of digital file or anything I want to print that's bigger than any printer I own.
That's the part that's scary, is that I talked about in the book that I've got a Leica M3 that was a great uncle's. And I said I could take that M3, throw a roll of film in it today, and go out and take photographs, and they'll look fantastic. yet I can find a digital camera that's 10 years old, and there's a very good chance I might not be able to make it work with my computer. And that's frightening, that that technology became obsolete that fast.
Another thing, too, is the archivability of digital. I mean, there's a great service going on now from DigiNeg that takes your digital file and uses a writer and writes it back to a film negative like they do in motion picture work. And that's great, but it's sort of defeating the purpose, I think, to capture digital. Unless, like you said, I need to turn a job, I need it out this afternoon, I'm working for a paper, I'm doing this. Yeah, you can still develop C41 in the closet in 10 minutes. But really, I think there's definitely a realm and you need digital for certain things.
Absolutely. If I was an art journalist where I might want film for, if you're going to be gone in really remote areas where you might not be able to get battery, you're really looking for a stable, manual, all-mechanical camera, film makes a lot of sense. But for most journalists and a lot of wedding photographers, the digital does make sense. But I think for a lot of other people, especially like landscape photographers, that's one where I think it's trickier. You see these people, they see the new digital bags coming out that are $35,000 and $40,000. I hear photographers talking about going out to buy it to take their landscape photographs, and I kind of look at them and scratch my head. I'm like, boy, you can buy yourself a great scanner and probably 40,000 rolls of 30,000 rolls of film. You'd be set for the foreseeable future, as opposed to a piece of technology that in 3 years, by the industry standard, is going to be obsolete. I think buying, thinking in terms of what's going to give you the best bang for the buck is important.
Well, no, I mean, look at an example. A 1DS Mark III resolves a resolution of, what, 2,720 lines or something. Well, 35mm film is 2,800 plus. Unless you go with some crazy ADOC special high-res imaging film that does even more. I mean, really, like you said, you can get a $50 camera. You can use a Pentax K1000 and get the same high-quality resolution as you can with a 1DS Mark III. Yes, the 1DS Mark III has no noise to a point, and then there's some other factors there involved, but really, is it $8,000 or $100?
Right. Exactly, and it's a tough sell. I have so many of my students who study with me, I tell them, look, take your digital camera, that's fine, but remember that old Nikon camera you have that all your SLR lenses will still work on? Why don't you load that up with a roll of the Ektar and stuff it in your bag? And when you're doing that landscape that you really, really, really want to scan, shoot it with that. And I said, you'll be blown away at the difference, especially on a good scanner. It's just night and day. Right now, one of the trends that I'm sort of watching and I'm sort of embracing myself is the whole alt process trend. People have always been obviously interested in platinum and palladium, but I've noticed that pinholes and zone plates and making your own cameras and these sort of the plastic toy cameras. I mean, I'm a big advocate. The simpler the capture system, the better. My entire whole second book was Polaroid positives from Holga. And I kind of joked, I said, I've got one shutter speed, and I just keep pressing the button, but the prints were beautiful. And I laughed when people were coming to the studio. I said, I've got an $8 camera and a $30,000 printer. What does that tell you about my workflow? I said, it's crazy when you look from one end to the other, but I like the idea in a lot of cases of low-tech input, input that doesn't require you to have a computer science degree, input that can be one that's motivated by the emotional energies of the scene that you're trying to photograph. And so the technology, in my opinion, needs to be transparent. The easier the camera, the less the buttons, the less the menus, the better. Capture that great negative that has the full expressive range of what you want, and then work on it in the computer. To me, that really makes the most sense.
Definitely so. So what would be your chief takeaway if you want to get across some information here? We're going to talk about what you're doing, the websites and your artwork, and you got some great bags and some other stuff going, but what would you consider to be your number one tip to someone that is an analog photographer now, maybe someone that's listening to this that's a digital that wants to play with some analog? What's your thoughts?
My thoughts would be is go out and get yourself a camera. You don't have to spend a lot of money. That's the best part, is that there's so many great old analog film cameras out there. Get yourself a roll of film. If you don't have a scanner, buy yourself a scanner. Spend yourself a few $100. Get a decent scanner. Realize there might be a little learning curve, but it's not bad. And just start to play and have fun. And remember that we all got into photography because it was fun. If the computer or the scanner or whatever starts to frustrate you, just walk away. It'll be patiently waiting for you there when you come back. And just sort of explore and see what you can do. I think that too many people have sort of this narrow path view of what is photography. And if you look back 100 years, back into the pictorialism, photography was really a broad sort of term. There was so much going on, so many different types of print processes being done. And then we all went into this sort of modernist, tighter sort of framework now for almost the last 100 years. And to me, what got me interested in digital was the ability that I could now print on anything. I could make a print look like a platinum print. I could print on these uncoated papers. I could do just about anything to a file, and that was exciting. biggest thing I would say is if you want to get into hybrid art and if you want to start doing these films, just realize that anything's possible if you're willing to sort of think about it for a little bit and try everything. Experimentation is key.
No, I think this is definitely true. So, Stephen, let's talk about the Fidgetal Revolution. Of course, you wrote the book. You have a weekly show. Give me a little more background on what you're doing over there so people can actually learn and take advice and learn what you've been doing, and you're sharing all this great work that you're doing with everybody.
Sure. The Fidgetal Revolution, once again, it's a site that I started because I wanted to sort of have an honest conversation about all aspects of photography, whether it's digital or analog or hybrid. Everything is on the table. Now, one thing that's important about the site is that the Fidgetal Revolution is a sponsor-free site. I accept no advertising, and I have no sponsors. I completely underwrite the site myself. And the purpose of that is that if I like somebody, I praise them. If I don't like them, I yell at them. And I want to be able to freely do that on my site at all times. And that's what's nice, is that also somebody can bring something up to me on the site, and I can talk about anything. And the discussions on the website are very broad. We've talked about things from print surface resolution, which is a term that I came up with to discuss what is truly the optimum resolution for a particular paper and ink, to different developers, to lenses, to cameras. It's a really open-ended discussion. Right now, we're averaging around 25,000 hits a month on the website, and I want it to grow. I truly started the site because I love photography, and I really felt that photography was going in a really bad direction. And I was hoping that having this honest dialogue and having a place where people could talk about everything was important. One thing I do on the site, I do have products that I sell on the site, from camera straps to camera bags that I've designed. And I think it's important, this is something that's kind of weird, I didn't design any of these products to actually sell to clients. That's the thing that I think is also important to know. I'm an active working photographer, and the strap that I make, the bag that I have, all those items were originally made for myself. Because I wanted a better strap than I could find. I wanted a better bag than I could find at a store. I wanted information on exposure with a Diana camera. So I built all these things for myself. And shortly after doing that, my students were asking me, wait, would you make me one of those? And then I realized that that would be a way maybe to sort of underwrite some of the site through sales of the product and stuff. And that's worked out well. I mean, I have to say, it's nice. Not going to retire on it, but it's nice because it does sort of cover some of the costs of the articles that I do.
Right, well, you're going to need to pay for your time somehow. I mean, the rent keeps coming no matter what, so.
Yeah, absolutely, and that is true. And I do sell a lot of the bags. The Bare Bones bag, which I came out with probably 6 months ago, has been really well received by a lot of rangefinder users. It's arguably, I think, the most durable non-padded camera bag ever made. I mean, you know, with the Y-strap and the No-Pod and the Wrist Wonder, you got to love the catchy names. This is what happens when it's cold winters in Vermont. You got a lot of time to think about the stuff. So we've come out with all these different products, but as I said, they were all originally for me, for the purposes of my own work. That brings me actually to the newest product that I'm hoping to bring out. We're not positive if we're going to yet, but I'm really into pinhole and zone plate photography right now. I'm doing an awful lot of pinhole and zone plate work, and I'm shooting with a Leica M7, and I wanted a pinhole and zone plate system for my Leica M. Well, there's body caps available, but that's really about as far as it goes. This is true for most 35mm SLR or digital SLR cameras. You can pretty much get a pinhole body cap or zone plate, but there's not a lot else out there on the market if you want to work in that sort of format. I've been working with Matt Abelson of Abelson Scope Works. I own a Hex Omniscope pinhole camera system that he makes, and we've developed a system called the Pinzoni, stands for pinhole zone plate. And what it's going to be is a multi-focal length zone plate pinhole system for the Leica M. So it'll have a 28, a 35, a 50, a 75, a 90, and a 135mm. It's basically extension tubes. And then there is a turret on the front that has up to four different either pinholes or zone plates or slits or photon sieves mounted in it, and they're interchangeable. So you can truly customize what you want to carry for that day, and you just flip the turret to the different settings and shoot. And what's exciting to me is that I originally, once again, designed this idea for myself. And then I was talking to Matt, and we're doing some testing. We're going to see if this is something maybe we want to make 15 or 20 of them. They're fairly labor-intensive to make. But I've noticed that Panasonic and Olympus now have adapters to allow you to use Leica lenses on their Micro Four Thirds systems. And the nice part is this has a Leica mount. So these Pinzoni systems, technically speaking, would work on all the Leicas, all the Zeiss Icons, all the Voigtlanders. And they'll also work on the digital Panasonic systems with the adapter.
Wow, that sounds pretty cool.
Yeah, I was pretty pumped. I didn't realize that was going to be the case. And that was sort of one of the impetuses to sort of maybe wanting to move that forward. It made sense to me to make a system like this for a Leica M7, any kind of Leica, really, because you're not having to look through the pinhole of the zone plate. You've got the rangefinder. So it's very easy to compose your image. You're not having to try to squint through F145 or something. So it's just sort of a natural system to work with.
No, I think that's interesting. I think people should play around more with the zone system plate and the pinhole camera stuff. It's pretty fun.
It is fun, and that's one of the things that I always advocate to my students is that photography is supposed to be fun. We all got into this because it was fun. And mixing it up, whether you're choosing a different lens or mounting a Holga lens or a Diana lens on SLR, or whether it's digital or film or putting a pinhole cap on, all these kind of things, they're tools, but they're also things to keep everything fresh. And they keep what you're doing fun, and they keep you sort of reinventing your obsession. And I think that's important, sort of keep your creative juices flowing.
Definitely so. So, Stephen, make sure you give me the information here. Let's go over all this stuff so we can find out where people can go see about, of course, the great website, the podcast you're doing, this information, the reviews and the articles, and then, of course, some of the cool stuff you're up to.
Sure. I actually, last night, built a new website that is a hub site that all the other sites can be accessed from because I have over 12 websites right now, and I have 3 more coming online in the next month. So I decided that's too long a business card. So the best website to go to is photogonzo.com, where everything photographic is cool. So it's just photogonzo.com. On that site, there's a list of all the websites. There's also RSS feeds coming in from all the different websites, as well as Twitter updates and stuff like that. So in one spot, they can kind of see what's going on all the sites. And that's really sort of the best way.
No, I think that's great because, like you said, you do have a few websites.
It's kind of a nightmare. And they just keep seeming to grow and grow and grow. It made more sense to sort of have one sort of central site to work from. And also, if anybody's ever in Vermont, our studio's Indian Hill Image Works, which is one of the websites you can link to. We're always open by appointment. People can stop out. And that's one of the things we do, printing and scanning and consulting and teaching. Somebody can come out and have a cup of coffee if they want. I mean, we try to create an environment where it's artists working for artists. And so it sort of creates this support network for artists, and it's a place they can come out and talk about stuff. It's open to anybody at any time.
No, I think that's great stuff, and we definitely look forward to chatting and seeing you here soon. And
absolutely.
I appreciate you taking the time today to chat with us, tell us about the Digital Revolution, and we look forward to having you back on the program to talk about some more topics in depth, and just a great overview today, and I do appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Stephen.
Have a good day.
There you go. Stephen Schaub. Great stuff going on with Stephen. You definitely got to check out his radio show. He's got some cool stuff going on, some great insight into analog capture, hybrid workflows. No matter what anybody thinks anymore, unless you're doing basically traditional black and white darkroom or even some guys that are doing color, analog photography now involves a digital component. Even if you take your film to a lab, it's developed and then it's scanned and it goes into a machine to make prints. Great stuff going on with Stephen. Definitely check out his website. And of course, the Inside Analog Photography radio program has been brought to you by Fujifilm, making life more colorful over at www.fujifilmusa.com/professionally. Definitely check out their Instax wide format instant cameras. Really cool stuff going on. Our friends at Richard Photo Lab at richardphotolab.com, DR5 for black and white chrome at dr5.com. Our friends over at Iger Studios, the place for high resolution scans using their Aztec Premier with a 3-micron engine with resolution to 8,000 ppi. Definitely check them out over at www.igerstudios. That's eigerstudios.com. Upstrap at upstrap-pro.com. And our media partners of the Analog Photography User Group, the place on the web for all things traditional photographic process, black and white, color, wet plate, you name it, it's all going on over at apug.org, the Analog Photography User Group. Definitely want to check them out. We'll be back next week with more great analog photography.